All right, welcome to another episode of That So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Jerry Coolidge, Silent Phil on the ones and twos. We're back. It's sunny, the weather's great, and we got fresh news. Just what we need, more news. Jerry, get some news for us, Alec, here today.
Yes. News is breaking. News is breaking as we record this. City Manager Patrick Duhaney is accepting a new job in the same job in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Well, wow. What does that mean? What's that mean for the city moving forward?
I have to say I did not see this coming just yet. You do, you know, this is the mayor's second term, as we talk about all the time here. I don't even think I need to go into it, but you do see at the end of, you know, the administration starts to leave, expecting there's going to be a turnover. That's government 101. It just happens. In fact, Bobby Dillon, Mayor Cranley's chief of staff, they announced last week she's going over to Procter & Gamble with Holly Stutz-Smith, who's the communications director for the mayor, stepping into Bobby's role. So we're already starting to see those changes there too. But the city manager, I mean, we were in the middle of a pandemic, so I've heard, and a budget crisis. Mm-hmm. And so this news is like really just absolutely stunning today.
Well, and it comes as public meetings begin on the upcoming budget, which will kick in on July 1st and has to be passed by, I guess, 11:59 p.m. on June 30th, correct?
Yes, and I do expect, of course, the city manager to stay through this is a crazy, you know, couple of days here coming up. He's not leaving immediately, obviously.
But nonetheless,
you know,
more chaos.
This is his budget.
Correct. I mean, nonetheless, you throw in another more chaos into the mix of a $73 million budget deficit. You're expecting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people weighing in on this budget here. And I guess, Sherry, what's the next step in terms of who could replace Patrick Duhaney?
Well, I mean, this news is so fresh, it's really hard. But I am hearing that the interim will be Paula Boggs-Muthing, the city solicitor, who has a lot of experience over at City Hall. She's been with the Cranley administration the entire time. Obviously a lawyer, but it'll be interesting to see how the process works. Because typically, the mayor puts forward a candidate, council, and then council approves. And so council's technically the hiring entity of a city manager, and only they can fire one, as we learned with Harry Black. And so it'll be interesting to see how that goes over. I mean, technically, we could see the mayor not put forward somebody at all through the rest of the term, and she just remains the interim. And so that leaves open, if he doesn't put forward somebody, how could council hire that person? And so
let me be clear. The mayor, you're allowed to put an interim in the job without approval from council?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's what I see happening, especially now with it only being a year and a half left on this term and the mayor term limited out at the end of next year. That's just my thought on it. What's yours?
You know, I mean, why risk, you know, more chaos, right? With the whole Harry Black scenario, and you just put a trusted person in there, and you go on with how things are going to be. You know, we do have three assistant city managers, and that is John Jewick, who, you know, does have ties. He came up kind of through David Mann, and he has a lot of credentials and has been an assistant city manager for a while. Mm-hmm. Cheryl Long, who came from one of the suburbs, which is escaping me at the moment, and Chris Bigham, who's the budget director, newly in that role. But I think, you know, the city manager just really wanted him in the city manager's office and close because he knows where all the money is.
Mm-hmm. Always and is good at his job.
Definitely. He's unflappable. I have to tell you, with all the chaos at City Hall, he is the one person. He's a numbers guy. He hears the numbers. He's going to make them work. He understands he has to get along with everybody. He's trying to make everybody's, ideas fit them in. And where could that money be? Just honestly, just a stabilizing force over there.
Never
hear his name.
Sounds like the perfect person for that role, because never has a numbers person been more important than right now with the $73 million budget hole and certainly all the uncertainty surrounding that. I guess when you look at the next year and a half of the final term of the mayor and of what, six council members, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, you think about who would want that job and want to come here and know that they could be out again when there's a new mayor coming in January of 21.
Well, there is that too. But the only thing I was thinking, of course, the two named mayoral candidates, and you had a list of people.
January of 22, sorry.
In your column over the weekend of people who could jump into the race, which I encourage people to read because it's quite the list. But at the moment, the two people on council are the mayoral candidates, David Mann and P.G. Sittenfeld. So they would be there to kind of, and they do align with their ideals and such. And so there could be a city manager pick, because at the moment, of somebody who would think they would have job stability, but I'm not sure that's going to be the case.
Do you honestly see P.G. Sittenfeld and John Cranley coming together, singing Kumbaya, and agreeing on a city manager that could stay on beyond John Cranley's term?
No, never mind. Let's just be honest.
Oh, that one got me. I needed a good laugh.
I mean, I think, with either of the people, I think that we still will, with the candidates now or whoever might, if there's going to be extra any of the people that's on your list, we are going to see a sea change over there. There's going to be new people in leadership and some new direction, I think.
By the way, I forgot to mention this at the top, but our guest today is Channel 5 reporter and anchor Curtis Fuller. Looking forward to having him on. The coverage of his coverage of the protests was just awesome, and looking forward to having him on. Actually, we got to make it clear with him that he ran for mayor in 2001, so I don't know if he if he had taken a leave of absence from Channel 5 and it covered the 01 unrest, or was at that time running for mayor. I want to believe he was running for mayor and had taken a leave from the TV station. But we'll check that out with him. And certainly there's a lot of perspective we want to ask him about and what's going on right now. And I don't know, maybe he was one of the people's names I threw out there as a potential mayoral candidate. He's been in TV for 30 years and certainly won the primary in 2001 against Charlie Lucan and turned around and lost the general election. That primary, by the way, was on the 9/11. And so it'll be interesting to have him on and get his perspective on what's going on. Maybe we should ask him about his future. And the reason why I put his name out there is because I heard his name from some political folks on the inside who mentioned him as thinking, hey, he would be a good candidate for mayor in 2021. And I think the thought there is that they thought he was a good candidate back in 01 and is, 30 years in TV, and maybe he wants to move on to give another shot at politics. So it'd be interesting to have Curtis Fuller on.
I know, when we talk about guests, and sometimes it's very at the last minute, I do try and think about who's that so Cincinnati. Right. And he's definitely among those people. And I've been watching him, throughout the protests. I've done a lot of helping, not necessarily haven't been on the streets and doing a lot of rewritings, a lot of perspective things from coming here and covering the aftermath of 2001. And I have one eye on what our reporters are doing, live Facebooking and everything. And one eye on what, he has to say, because he's been out in it. And so I'm looking forward to talking to him for sure. And I've enjoyed his perspective and his coverage of everything. It's just been, I just feel like he's offered us a lot.
And one other, we have a two-guest segment today, as we'll also have Ohio Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper in on the hot seat on the teleconference as we record our podcasts over teleconference. He will not be here in his role as the Ohio Democratic Party chairman. He'll be in his role as an author, a new book out. I believe this is his third book.
It is The Voter File.
The Voter File.
So I feel like we'll probably devote a little bit of political conversation, but I love political thrillers. I've read all his books, and he can weave a tale. He really can. The Wall Street Journal just praised him up one wall and down another over the weekend. I mean, it seems like he has found his new, role as an author.
Have you read The Voter File?
I have. You know, his books feature a reporter named Jack Sharp, and we'll talk about this, who's a reporter at the Youngstown Vindicator, where I worked briefly earlier in my career. And
all right,
so
the Vindicator.
I really enjoy that.
I said, RIP Vindicator, by the way.
It's well, there anymore. Is that, yeah. Like, because that's, in nameplate only at this point. It closed, and it was kind of folded into the Warren, Ohio paper.
Okay.
And it's, they kept a couple reporters who do amazing jobs. I read all their work. David Skolnick, political writer like you are in the state.
Yeah, he does a good job.
So he's still there. I mean, I just was home 2 weeks ago while Alex was filling in for me on the podcast, and he had like 3 stories on the front page.
Before we jump to David Pepper, budget hearings are getting ready to happen this week. What do you expect?
A huge crowd. Let's start there. You know, there's typically 3 budget hearings. They last like 2 hours. They kind of trail off like as we go along. And they were setting things up yesterday for just hundreds of people to be speaking. They are doing it at the convention center this year. For social distancing purposes, it has a capacity of 500. They're allowing people to call in for Zoom calls. And so there are so many people signed up. They added hours. Tonight it is, Tuesday night it's supposed to go 6 with a midnight cutoff. That's right, midnight. Thursday.
Oh, wow.
Thursday they decided to start earlier, 4 to midnight. And Friday at noon until everyone has spoken. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, we're expecting a crowd no matter what. Do we go all this Friday long? I'm not sure. But this is a budget where people are really crying out with this defund the police. Yeah, I think we'll see some streetcar people too, which the streetcar is not funded in the budget. And the police department is. And we saw, a large crowd of people, maybe 100 people outside City Hall yesterday on Monday saying they want to defund the police. Now, of course, that's just like a hashtag, and it really means put more emphasis on social services instead of having police come out to every call. I'm not sure that's something that's going to be done in 15 days.
Yeah.
Like, this is a longer conversation and an important one with where we are right now in the world, and I don't want to dismiss this, but I'm just having a lot of trouble seeing this council cutting the police budget in a way that really gets to the heart of serving our community with social services with a 15-day plan. So we will see what happens. The mayor and the city manager put forward a budget together, recommended, and they did not defund the police. But there are a lot of conversations to be had there. We'll see how that goes, though.
Well, let's not forget the politics that are involved. Is all the politicians at City Hall, and most of them anyway, genuflect to the Fraternal Order of Police and Dan Hills, who we've had on the podcast. And so certainly the politics are at play, especially with 2 of the mayoral candidates being on the council, and David Mann and PG Sittenfeld. And so they've got to play this very carefully in terms of not trying to rock the boat too much with the FOP, because that FOP endorsement, that FOP support in a mayoral race is very critical, or has proven to be very critical anyway in past years. So your final thought on that?
Well, when you mention both of them, it is fraught with politics. There's no taking it out, especially this year. But, I think this is where we're going to start to see the differences. We talked about this last week, I think, or we just talked about it privately, I forget, between PG and David. And that really matters, though, if we see, you know, David kind of go the more path of this recommended budget. He's the sixth vote on some things, and that and that makes it the veto proof. And so where he falls on things, I think we could start seeing these differences, and it might not give them the six votes for all the things that they want, because now we're introducing a new layer of things into it. And so we'll definitely see this mayor's race get kicked off here.
Wow. Okay, let's jump over and two guests today. So let's first bring in briefly David Pepper.
Okay, so as we said, like the first of our two special guests this week, and this one is a welcome back to That So Cincinnati, David. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, the last time we had you on, we had a big conversation about Ohio politics. You're the Democratic Party chair. We kind of walked through your life as a councilman and a commissioner. But you have, I think, what was maybe a secret side and not so secret anymore. You're an author. And congratulations on your new book, The Voter File.
Thank you. Yeah, I started writing in some ways in frustration years ago. I didn't really know it was going to go anywhere, and I'm lucky that it's actually turned out well. So I'm excited about the new book coming out.
So this is your third book, and we talked a little bit when we were introducing you. We talked a little bit about your, you know, reporter, your main protagonist, Jack Sharp. What made you start writing about a reporter? I mean, if I was you, I think I would be like writing as a politician.
Well, you know, it's funny, as you may know, way back before I ever entered politics, I actually was a reporter all through college. I worked actually for the Press Commune newspapers. I tried to be an intern for the Inquirer, but I got rejected. So instead, I worked for the Press Community Papers. It was a great job, and I spent all my years in college as a reporter and then the managing editor of my college newspaper. And so I kind of always had sort of a reporter view on things. I hope people see that. Like, I've always respected the media. And I also think in terms of a book, it's a great narrator, because a reporter, as you know, is out digging and finding things. And in my books, my character, his name is Jack Sharp, is that's what he does. He's a reporter who sometimes, almost from dumb luck, stumbles into major scandals. So I think having the world seen through the eyes of a reporter, I think, is interesting for people, especially in the moment where now we're seeing, you know, all sorts of attacks on the media, fake news and all that, which obviously I don't agree with. And I also, one of the things I chose, and I chose a paper where I used to work at, I chose a mid-sized paper from a town, in this case Youngstown, because I also think there's the world of journalism, especially newspapers, is so much more complicated now as mid-sized and small-town papers struggle. And so I didn't just pick any reporter. I picked someone who's living the challenges of these tough times for mid-sized and small-town newspapers.
Which are important in every community, no matter the size of your newspaper.
I agree with that. And by mid-size, I almost would say, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they play an important role. But if there wasn't an Inquirer, if there wasn't Youngstown Vindicator, if there wasn't, you know, the Mansfield paper, there's nothing covering the local news at all. And that's why, you know, that these papers are, you know, beyond the big national ones, are the front lines. And whether it's holding local government accountable or whether it's digging up, you know, local features, if they're not there, there's nothing. And that's another reason why I wanted to focus. You know, there's been a lot of Bob Woodward books about the famous journalists of the biggest papers. I think the role of our sort of local papers is huge and is being eroded by all the challenges of the 21st century economy.
So in this book, it's called The Voter File, like you just write to the heart of things. This is such an important part of politics now, and it's a good way for people to learn about it, just how much information, you know, the political process knows about voters. And so Tell us about the voter file, because it really sets up the book, I think.
Sure. So the voter file is essentially the database that every campaign builds up over the course of their campaign about all the voters that they want to, you know, have vote for them in their November election. And it's these databases are housed by the national and state parties, but each candidate sort of has their piece of the voter file. And, you know, versus 20 years ago, where you'd knock on doors and sort of write everything down on a piece of paper, which is what I did when I started. Now it's a very sophisticated system, and there's a lot of information on voters. A lot of voters wouldn't know this. And I write about it because, you know, the plot is basically what would happen if sort of ill-intentioned forces were to hijack a voter file. And this is sort of the worst-case scenario. They would do a ton of damage is obviously the point. But I also think that sort of the whole question, you know, as we talk about data and privacy, and we're concerned about what does Facebook do with our data, what do companies do with their data, you know, I think that some transparency about having these voter files is also important. So for those who aren't in politics, I'm getting a lot of responses like, my gosh, we didn't know anything about this. And I do think it's something that obviously parties and candidates and everyone else have to be very careful in protecting this, because it is, in the end, information on a lot of people.
And so your first two books, you self-published, you kind of wrote, well, you're doing your day job, which you're still doing, I know. But this time you have a publisher, is that right?
Yeah,
major publisher.
Yeah, I was really excited. I mean, I'm Putnam just, you know, agreed to buy this and the book and touted, and you know, in the world of political thrillers, they're as good as it gets. So I was honored when a couple of years ago they based on the strength of my first two books, you know, bought this. And in the world of book writing, that's a big deal, and I was really excited about it. And again, I look back when I started the first book called The Voter File. I mean, sorry, The People's House. I didn't even have a goal. I just was sort of writing a story. And this is something I'd say to anyone. If you have a story you want to write, just start writing it. That's all I did. But to go from that moment where I just started writing a story to having a publisher be excited enough that they buy and agree to publish your book was really exciting. And you know, that the good news about that is it means that it's in bookstores all over the country right now, which is obviously, as a writer, really exciting.
You had a chance to see it at Joseph Beth, right? His things are reopening.
Yeah, it's a Joseph Beth. They've been very good to me, and if people are interested in buying it, I would say, you know, support your independent bookstores. There's a great little bookstore in Madeira called The Bookshelf. They have it. I went and signed copies the other day. I signed a bunch of copies at Joseph Beth, so people who are in the Cincinnati area, go there. But, you know, what's funny is I'll have people all over the country. I got one the other day. From Manchester, Vermont, someone said, "Hey, I just saw your book in this great independent bookstore." So the thing that's so exciting about a publisher like Putnam is they have a distribution network that I never would have, and all of a sudden you have sightings of your book all over the country. That's actually really fun.
And I don't want to let you off the phone, because it is, we do talk politics here. You had, you know, quite a phone call about your books at one point from...
Yeah, I had one of the more interesting moments. You know, another highlight in addition to Putnam liking my books is I had a call maybe 2 years ago out of the blue where suburban New York area code, and the person says, "Mr. Pepper, do you have 2 minutes? The president wants to talk to you." And I thought, okay, and I was trying to figure out. And I said, yes, there's only one right answer to that question.
Yes.
And I was like, is this Trump? Who is this? And finally I figured out, in my mind, I thought, I bet you Bill Clinton must have read my books. And sure enough, about a minute later, excuse me, he gets on the phone and he says, "David, I picked up The People's House yesterday afternoon and I read it all the way through. I didn't put it down. And I'm halfway through The Wingman, which is my second book." And we, you know, and I knew him a little bit. We talked a few minutes at a time, a few times. We talked for more than an hour about books, and he's a big thriller reader. He also wrote one, and he was in the middle of finishing it. So, yeah, we spent an hour talking, and I'm honored that he's read the new book and is on the cover saying this is a good book. So it was pretty awesome. And what's good about him is this is not just some political connection. He reads these things every day. So to have him saying it's good, I think people know means something, because he really, you know, he loves these types of thrillers, and he apparently really liked this one. So we were excited about that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I suspect we're probably going to have you back because, yes, we're in a pandemic. Yes, we're talking about the city budget a lot, but I do think we have a huge election later this year, and I feel like you're going to be offering us some insight.
Yeah. So, well, let me just say, I think that Ohio is now seen as a swing state that it's been. Some were in denial of this a couple of years ago, but if we are blue, and some of your readers or listeners won't like this, but if we're blue, we both end the Trump presidency and we end gerrymandering in Ohio. So there's a lot at stake. And I think the reason you see Trump spending on TV now in Ohio is he knows he's in trouble here. And if he loses here, that's it. So, yeah, it's going to be a really wild 6 months.
I have a lot of advertisements from the president in all of my social media feeds as sponsored. And I think that's from the voter file, maybe.
That's true. He's got you tagged.
All right, David, thanks so much.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
All right, thanks again to David Pepper. And we jump right from our first guest right to our, what we like to call our special guest on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome onto the so-called hot seat, Channel 5 anchor and reporter, long time local presence on television here in Greater Cincinnati, Curtis Fuller. Curtis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I'm following good people if I'm following David Pepper.
We talked about his book.
Yeah.
We had him on to talk about his new book. And wow. One of the things that we wanted to ask you about is the perspective of covering the protests recently, and you covered it in 2001 as well for Channel 5, and obviously covering it again now. Can you share with listeners the perspective of covering kind of both of those, and what's the differences, or were there any similarities, or institutional knowledge?
Well, I tell you, and I've been covering protests. This is my 40th year in broadcasting, believe it or not. And
wow.
So over
no,
the
I don't
years,
believe that.
Yeah, over the years, I've covered many protests, and I'll get to 2001. But the first big protest I remember covering happened. I couldn't have been less than a year into the business, 6 months into television. And it happened in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, this is 1981. I was in radio first, then in TV. 1981 in Milwaukee, police stop a 22-year-old young man in Milwaukee. He was suspected of a crime he didn't commit. Next thing you know, this young man dies in police custody. His name, Ernest Lacey. And he died because a police officer put his knee on the back of his neck. That's 1981. And at the time, and really up until now, it was the largest protest I had seen. I mean, people flooded the streets. That is something that I've carried with me over the years. I mean, in addition to my own personal experience of, you know, being a kid, looking out my front door in 1968 and seeing the National Guard out there after Dr. King was assassinated. So, yeah. I mean, that stays with you. You know, let's fast forward to 2001. Look, there have been things bubbling in our city for years. There had been several incidents. People had expressed some concern about people being killed by police and the circumstances behind that. So people had been voicing concerns for several years. So it was bubbling up in 2001. And then when Timothy Thomas gets shot and killed, you just felt, I mean, I know I did. I felt this was the straw. Because I remember the incident happened Friday night into Saturday, and I was speaking someplace at Saturday night, and it was just through the air. You go to that following Monday, and the infamous meeting at City Hall that just was a crazy scene. And then from there, people took to the streets, and then for it. So it was, 2001, obviously we hadn't seen anything like that in Cincinnati. Yeah, there'd been some protests, but nothing like this. And fortunately, there were people, community leaders who immediately took to the street, tried to calm people down, to maintain as much order as possible along with the police. But it was a different police department at that time. So it was interesting. You know, they immediately put in a curfew to shut things down a few days, I think about 2 days into it. We had national people flooding into the city, whether it was Martin King III and many others, you know, came into the city. Cincinnati became the epicenter.
Yeah.
I compared that to what's happening now. Much different, obviously, in the sense that this did not happen here. It clearly has resurrected concerns by people in the community, as you guys well know, about police reform, what the department is doing. Fortunately for our department, when you step back and try to be as objective as possible, I mean, we are doing an amazing job compared to where we were in 2001. And when I hear what other departments are doing, I think, wow, Cincinnati really has made tremendous strides. And thanks to the collaborative agreement, really that has taken us to where we are today. Could more be done? Oh, absolutely. And I think the chief is sincere, and folks working in the department are sincere that they want to be the best department they can be. You know, when you talk to Newdegate and others, they are committed to making this department good. You know, I mean, the chief has been on the department for over 30 years, so you know he's invested. And when you talk to him, you know he believes that they can be the best. But it takes a lot of work. It is a lot of work. And unfortunately, they're at least at a point where they're listening, willing to listen, willing to work with the community.
I do think the conversation is headed, of course, this whole defund the police idea. And I'm not sure, like, that gets at the reforms. To me, when I'm looking at it, a lot of these expenses are bringing us forward. You know, like, if you look at the line items, right? Personnel, expanding the upper ranks of the department allowed for more diversity and more female officers. And so I feel like, you know, it's a little bit top heavy, but in the same sense, then that allowed for that expansion and to really start bringing different ideas and voices into upper management. And if you look at the equipment line item, it's like, well, we just bought very expensive, state-of-the-art body cameras that go on automatically. Like, we had an officer, you know, we haven't heard a lot about this lately. I do think about this, shot in the head, but his Kevlar helmet stopped that bullet and saved his life. Like, are we going to cut the equipment? Just these line items in the training, there's anti-bias training. They implemented a training program about the history of racism into things, and it's tailored specifically to Cincinnati. And so I definitely think, like, the idea of these social service agencies, all of these dollars are important in making sure that those things are in place so the police aren't responding to them. But the idea of defunding the police, like, some of this money got us all of this progress that we've had, is expensive.
Yeah, well, you know, I as soon as I heard the term floated the fund, you immediately think, wow, that's probably not the best choice of words to use, because I believe that people want reform. That's what they want. But to use the term defund, as has been stated nationally, that just sort of shifts the conversation to think, well, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to get rid of the police department? And no, I don't believe that is the overall goal. I do believe that people want changes, they want reform, and they want things very similar to what we've attempted to do here in Cincinnati with, you know, certain training and, you know, because we just have, what, less than 1,100 officers. Sometimes we forget that this isn't a force of, you know, 10,000 people. This is 1,100 people managing a city of 330 plus thousand people. And so, and the police officers are not social workers. They are not social workers. They can get out there and they can help. And I would hope that what people are asking for is, yeah, they want assistance, they want other resources. And we've seen that in over the years. Let's say if there's a situation, you know, 25 years ago, there was a guy who was shot by police because he had a brick in his hand. People always talk about that. Well, now, you know, we have things in place, intervention. Maybe you bring somebody in to try to de-escalate this situation. I would hope that that's what people are really seeking. It's troubling, as you know, you watch this either locally or nationally, and you take situations that occur and people just wonder. I know I have, you know, what makes a police officer keep his knee on a guy's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds? You know, I can understand
the idea that they're allowed to do that.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, look, I understand. I mean, I amen to the officers who go out there, and they put their lives on the line, and it is a scary time for them. I understand that.
Curtis, in 40 years in journalism, you've covered thousands and thousands of news events and stories. How important is experience and having contact that you developed over those years, both in the police department and among citizens and in neighborhoods and communities? How important is that at a time in a big news event like the protests we've just been having?
Well, as you know, I think it's very important because it gives us perspective. It's important that I'm able to have a conversation with the chief of police and trust that what he's telling me is the truth to the best of his knowledge. And then also be sensitive to listen to and trust what the people on the street are saying. Both are passionate, both believe what they believe. And so it is very important. No doubt about it. I think it's very important.
You know, I have to say, I said earlier in the podcast that I have definitely been watching your coverage, and I appreciate that perspective. But definitely, I feel like the other thing that we have seen are some of our younger journalists, in particular at the Inquirer, and I want you to name somebody at your station who's been doing an amazing job, Brianna Rice with us and Madeline Mitchell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Dion Hampton, I love seeing them out on the streets. They're kind of new to the city. Their younger perspective has been amazing too, and they're just really shining. And I just, the difference that, like, I've learned a lot from both of the different ways of doing this reporting.
You know what?
You have had somebody out there in the middle of things that has been, her name is escaping me, but she's done really stunning work.
Like, yeah, you know, we've had a lot of people out there, and you're absolutely right. I've been watching them. Helena Battipaglia was out there that Friday night. Helena,
yeah, that's
also
who I'm referring to.
Yeah, and also Jeterra McGee. And what was so striking, Jeterra was actually interviewing the chief at the police station, outside the police station, and he was saying how things were going great that night and how peaceful, and just praising everybody, and that was true. And we flip over, I mean, immediately flip over to Elena, and all heck was starting to break out at the Justice Center. And what's refreshing to watch the young reporters, or maybe this is their first experience like this, it's all new to them. They're seeing it, you know, I start immediately comparing it to my past. But
right.
They're seeing this for the first time. They're, and so what we're seeing is their real fear at times of being out there and their perspective. So it's been good. And I think they've all done a great job. I think the only thing that they can't bring to the table that maybe more experienced journalists can, again, is that perspective of the past. You know, even, you know, we were talking about this whole notion of defunding police. You know, I mean, I immediately start to think, you know, when we use that term in education and in housing and a whole host of other things, you know, we should have that same outrage there. You know, we use, well, we're going to defund, you know, decrease spending in education, decrease spending here. And so there should be outrage there. And, you know, at the same time, you can't get so frightened by the outrage on the street. And it's something that's not talked about a lot. But look, these people, Dr. King used to use the phrase legitimate discontent. And so many who are out there expressing anger and frustration, much of it is legitimate discontent by just history poured into them. Look, none of us, no one is in favor of the vandalism and the looting. No one is in favor of vandalism and looting. But if you step back and really look at how change occurs, and it's not something that just easily happens. It becomes revolutionary in many ways. How that's played out is, it can be very uncomfortable at times. You know, you think back to Birmingham, and my friend Reverend Shuttlesworth, the late Fred Shuttlesworth, would talk about this. And you think of Birmingham before 1963. It was not a pretty place. And so it took the protests, and it took people seeing, the nation seeing young children being hosed down by these fire hoses and people being attacked by police dogs. That is not a pretty sight to see. But it took these uncomfortable images to force change. But no one likes the looting and the destruction. That's totally unnecessary. From my perspective, I would hope that does not happen. But I'm also mindful that history tells me that change occurs through revolutionary action. How we navigate through that is really our challenge.
Coming back to 2001, you and I, when we were talking about having you on earlier in our first segment of the podcast,
yeah.
To be clear to our listeners, I said I'd ask you, and then we actually did ask you off air,
mm-hmm.
But you covered the 2001 protesting and unrest. And then later on that year, decided to resign from Channel 5 and run for Cincinnati mayor. Talk about the decision that went into that and that race, and all the your process of moving from from a long journalism, successful journalism career to politics.
sometimes I look back and I wonder how I did it, why I did it. You know, I must tell you that, you know, the unrest happened in April. There were, you know, a couple of months there that I'm covering the stories and just starting to feel like we just weren't doing enough. We weren't speaking as journalists. I just didn't feel as though I was doing enough personally. And so yeah. I thought about it, prayed about it. It's funny, if I rewind three or four years, Bobby Stern, longtime politician, she took me out to lunch. This is 1997. Most people don't know this. She took me out to lunch and talked to me in, at that time, about running for office. And I looked at her and I said, "You must be crazy." And I had just signed a long-term deal with Channel 5, and my oldest daughter at the time was 10, and you know, my mom was getting older, and I was a caregiver there, so it just didn't seem like that was even in the cards. But I must admit, I didn't throw the idea in the garbage. I just sort of put it off to the side. So you move forward. 2001 rolls through. I'm doing great in my career. I was the main anchor, and things. I it's great. I had just gotten married. Life is going pretty good. And so as April rolled, but it's funny that year I had taken a lot of time off at the beginning of the year. And I kept telling people, I said, you know, I just feel like I need to get rested for something. I didn't know what it was, but I believe that I knew what was coming down the pike in somewhere in my spirit. So anyway, we get into this point of April, May, first part of June. And at some point, I'm trying to think. At some point, I think there might have been an article like the one you wrote, sort of fussing my name out there. And I said, all right, I'm going to see what happens. And so I sort of floated this balloon. So I floated this balloon by going down to the Board of Elections and taking out petition. You know, there's nothing, because I knew that before I got out of the door, the fact that I took out a petition to run for mayor would sort of circulate.
So things haven't changed.
and it sure did. And because I wanted to see, without making any commitment, what the response would be. I said, be interesting just to see what people think. I mean, if immediately everyone said, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, who is this knucklehead? You know, if I had gotten just slammed, then I would have immediately walked away from it and not think about it, because it would have been. Plus, I wanted to see how the managers at Channel 5 would respond to this balloon. So once it passed that test, all right, I said, wow, okay. You know, I could breathe a sigh of relief that I wasn't going to get pulled on the carpet for this. I then put it back on the shelf. It was just because people had been talking to me. A good friend of mine, Bob Humphreys, early in the year, he had talked about me running for office. And I said, Bob, I'm not going to run for office. So people have been planting this seed for months. And as I said, Bobby Stern for years. But it really was not something that I was watering. Then in probably early June or so, as we were getting closer to the deadline of submission for mayor and council, I realized that no one was running against Charlie. And I thought, Charlie Lucan. And yeah. I thought, wow, that surprised me that no one would challenge him. And it's no disrespect to him. It just seemed as though here we're at this point, we're at that point. And it would seem to me that someone would challenge him. Mm-hmm. And so I remember going on a vacation. I went to Canada for a few days with my best friend. And I came back. I arrived back in town, and it was a Saturday. And there was an article in the paper about no one, surely no one was going to run against him. And and so, again, this is starting to bubble up. And I say this to people all the time. I said it then, I'll tell you now. I mean, I really prayed hard about this. And, you know, when you say, you know, you get this sign, all I can explain to people is that there was something that I received that said, all right, go do this. And sure enough, that following Wednesday, I go into work, I tape a program as normal. And after I finish taping, I go into my news director's office. I said, I think you might want to sit down. And he said, uh-oh, what? And I said, you know what? I think I'm going to run for mayor. And he looked at me and, you know, we have conversation, good conversation. Anyway, that night, then I become the I had contacted the charter committee. And the reason I chose charter is because I knew Marion Spencer's background and charter and Ted Berry, people who I respected. Yeah. And so I contact them. They said, OK, we'll go for it. And I have a press conference that afternoon. And by 5 o'clock, I'm the lead story on the news. it was, and I must, then we go out and start collecting signatures. And so I needed 500, if I'm not mistaken. And in a 24-hour period, we got like well over 5,000 signatures. I don't think that's ever happened before. It was an amazing, I mean, and what was happening then, the radio station, I think WCIN and The Buzz, they were saying, well, Curtis is going to be here and he's going to be there and, you know, go sign the petition. And it was a whirlwind. And so we meet the deadline. We get all the signatures. But I tell you, that Friday, I felt like, now what? because all of a sudden everything just sort of disappeared, and I thought, what have I gotten myself into? And I had a window in my contract that I could have gone back. I had maybe a 10-day window. I could have actually just said, okay, I've lost my mind. I'm coming back.
So in there, you had resigned. Somewhere in there, you had resigned from Channel 5.
Yeah. I think that either that Thursday, maybe Thursday or Friday, I actually went back into the station. You start doing the paperwork and you really talk through how this is going to happen, how you exit out of here. But I actually had to resign my position. And you know, look, that was a huge, I mean, people sometimes think, okay, well, somebody else gave you a job or you got some money. So, no, I mean, I went from, you know, six figures down to zero overnight. I mean, that was it.
Yeah.
Think the best candidates run from a place of passion.
That's
people
right.
who've won, who really want, like, when change is, it comes from a place of passion, and when it's real change and not just, you know, change to say change.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that passion is important.
Well, and you know, I tell people it was the, I can't really explain. I mean, it was, would I do it again? Oh yeah. Under the same circumstance, I would probably do the same thing over. I never had any fear. I had concerns along the way, but I didn't have just that. I didn't have fear. You know, you think, wow, what's going to happen here? What if I make this decision? But I operated, I really remained prayerful throughout all of that. And it's amazing how, and I look back and I think, where did I get this idea, you know, to say what I said and the way I said it? And quite frankly, a lot of the proposals, if I could find those proposals and send them to you, you would probably be amazed at some of the things that were offered up. Very great ideas, and many of them have come to reality, not by my doing, but by reality. And it's interesting, it was a Post article in 2005 that said, and I remember calling the reporter and thanking him. I appreciated what he said. He was talking at the time that, you know, we had an African-American mayor. We had an African-American city manager at the time. We had head football coach was African-American, and the manager of the Reds was African-American. And the reporter said, all of that would not have happened had I not run for mayor. And I it blew me away, because I thought, you know, in many ways that's right, because Charlie Lukin was set to, he would have won that election as he did, and probably would have run for re-election in 2005, and things would have been different. Better, worse, who knows? You know, Charlie's a skilled politician, and I know he loves the city, he's committed to the city. Actually, I think he's still the longest serving mayor ever in the city, in the history of the city. So, but that's what that article said. I didn't say that. And so I'm real proud of what happened in 2001. I think about, you know, we always talk about voter turnout, and clearly the primary, which took place on September 11th, it was a low turnout, but it's not the lowest turnout. I mean, other people, there have been other primaries and that have been lower. And the general election, I don't remember the exact turnout, but it was pretty good. And in fact, I believe, I don't keep all these numbers in my head, but I believe that my vote count remains the second or third highest in the past 20 years. Now think about all the people who won for mayor. And I mean, talented people like David and many others, of course, our current mayor. But, you know, obviously Charlie has the highest vote count of anyone who's run for mayor in the past 20 years. And I believe I believe that mine is second, or it might be third. Mark Mallory might have gotten a higher vote count for me in one of his elections. And so that speaks volumes, not to me. It speaks volumes that people will turn out. What was interesting about 2001, despite the fact that I thought we were really trying to bring people together, when you get down the numbers, it went 80-20. I got 80% of the black vote. Charlie got 80% of the white vote, which was, when it was all over, that was a little disappointing, because I was hoping to break through. Now, strategy, there are 1,000 things that I would have done, I would do differently in the sense of running a campaign. One thing I did not do, I did not seek endorsements. Now imagine that.
You know, Casey and I get them in our email, like, who's who, like, and you just want to go into the world. But it's like, yeah, that's like a thing now.
Yeah, oh, that's, I mean, I didn't seek endorsements. And the reason I didn't is because I thought, well, if they don't endorse me, that's a negative. It's, if I start, if Charlie starts getting all these endorsements, that's going to knock me out of the box. And the only way I thought I could neutralize him was to say, I'm not seeking endorsements. Now, the word seek is a real key one, because implied in that is, if you want to give it to me, give it to me. But
it's much more regimented now with like plans.
That's right. That's right. And so what many organizations did, they did not endorse either one of us. Imagine that. So at one point, and I guess I can tell you this. I guess I can tell you this. At one point, I had the FOP endorsement, believe it or not.
Wow.
Now, can you imagine?
2001,
now,
yeah.
In 2001, I had the FOP endorsement. And I thought, wow, that's great. But then I thought, man, this could be a catch-22, because if I accept the endorsement, is that going to reflect in a negative way to the base that I knew I had, which was the African American community? And so I then tell the FOP, I'm not going to take the endorsement. And that was, you know, that was tough. That was a tough thing to do, because I knew that that would be powerful. And I knew that, that if that came out, it could be a plus, but I knew it would just box me in many ways that I felt I better not do this.
Let me ask you a question that's going to spin this forward, and then I'm going to let Jason ask you directly something very important. My question is, do you feel like, so we're seeing, you know, we do still have time, Jason and I, you know, often talk like the mayor's race is tomorrow. It's not.
Yeah.
You know, two candidates, council members, longtime council members, David Mann and P.G. Sittenfeld. Do you think that the city needs an African-American candidate in the mix? And do you think there will be one? And then we'll let Jason ask his question.
Yeah, you know, I read the article, it's an interesting question. First of all, you know, I love David Mann. I love PG. I think both of them are good servants for the city. And you know, David, I tease him all the time. You know, David knows the ins and outs of this town as well as anyone, and is committed to all communities. So both of them are very, very good candidates. But you do wonder if now is that time. It's the same way in 2001. And I believe that there probably will be an African American candidate who emerges. And the names that you floated in the story all are competent and capable of doing great things for the city. I, again, it's all about numbers. How many numbers can you get? And, you know, because of David's popularity, because of PG's popularity, it will be difficult for anyone to cut into that. Obviously, running for mayor, you know, the top two vote getters move on. And so is there someone capable of overriding one of them? Yeah, possibly, but it would be very tough. Very tough.
Well, you've set me up perfectly, Kurt.
That's what we do the best, Jason. Do it.
You know a good segue. After 40 years in TV. The article you referenced, I wrote a column over the weekend about. I'd heard this for a long time, for several months, about will there be an African American candidate in the upcoming mayor's race, and then I thought, you know, it's obviously still super early, but I thought, I'm gonna ask now. So I asked Christopher Smitherman, the vice mayor, and he said, hey, actually, in light of what is happening in our country right now, he said, I think his quote was, it calls on an African-American candidate to get in the race. Mm-hmm. And so I ask around, and, you know, there's political folks who pay attention to this stuff. And one of the names that came up was your name. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking back in, you know, 2001 mayor's race. And so I'm going to quit rambling. I'm going to say, is that something it, you would potentially be interested in doing?
Yeah, it's not on the radar. I was real humbled when I saw my name mentioned in your column. I really was, because that's a nice thing. You know, here I'm a guy from Pittsburgh originally. I've lived here longer than I lived in Pittsburgh, but mm-hmm. you know, people still tolerate the fact that I root for the Steelers.
I'm from Youngstown. I understand.
Yeah. But, you know, I love this city. I really love Cincinnati. And I think people know that. And the city has been kind to me. But it is not something on the radar. And so you say, well, why don't you just say no? Because I don't know I can't tell you. I can only tell you what is and what was. But it is not something on the radar. It's humbling to think that people would even think that I could help, but it's not something on the radar. I looked at the other names on the list, and I think you were dead on. I mean, Jan Michelle, I've known her the entire time I've been in town, and she would be a great, and she is a great public servant.
It's so great to see her on council. Her voice. I've loved watching this.
She is a good person, and I think she's showing that she's a good leader. But I think you were right whether or not she would choose this time to, you know, get. I know that she is friends with David, friends with PG. Obviously, PG selected her. So I don't know if that would work for her. You know, you look at Alicia, and if she's, I guess, depending on what happens in the Hamilton County Commissioner race, that would tell the tell there. Jason Dunn, a name that maybe some people might not know, but what a remarkable young man. He's got some great things. So his name is also in there that you mentioned, and a good leader. And I'm trying to think, was there someone else? And obviously, as you said, you know, Christopher, I applaud him for putting family first. Yeah. That's not talked about a lot. What a time that he's gone through with his personal loss, you know. Yeah. And, you know, his dad just passed away a few years ago. So I'm certain that the grief of that is still lingering. And then walking through that journey with his wife, but I applaud him. And if he felt that he could muster up enough to handle both, he too would be a great candidate. So the good thing is we have a tremendous amount of people out there, capable and most of them willing to serve the city, and mm-hmm. so that's a good thing. That is a good thing. And I'm not even anywhere near that jerky again.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
and Cecil Thomas was the other.
Cecil. Absolutely. You know, you look at. Again, Cecil and I have been friends for years. And mm-hmm. so I think about this guy. You know, I mean, look at his resume. I mean, a police officer for nearly 30 years, and then human relations counsel, and then up in Columbus. I mean, it's very impressive. And you and I both know we give our public servants a lot of heat, but they have to take a lot of criticism. Yeah. But it's a lot of work to be out there on the front line day in and day out. And then when you look at people who've done it, like David, for all these years, I don't know. That's more than I can think of. I mean, to think that David's been a council member, or a congressman, and mayor for all these years. Pretty impressive. So I will tell you this, a funny story. One of the first people I called to ask, should I run, was Marion Spencer, Marion and Donald Spencer. And they listened to me, and they said, no, I don't think you should run.
What do you think, of course, she's passed away. Yeah. What do you think she would tell you now?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I honestly don't know. I would be curious to know what she would have told me, too. I don't know. And I say that with all sincerity. I know she would tell me the truth, her truth. And but I don't know. I really don't know. And I always wonder what my dear friend Ernie Waits would tell me. I called him, and when I say he and Mrs. Spencer, a couple of the first people I called, and he too said, if I choose to do it, he would give me his full support. But he also, you know, warned me about the, you know, the rough roads, rough waters of politics. So,
yeah.
And, you know, I think people were just concerned that I was giving up so much. You know, I'm right in the, you know, heart of my career, moving up, and to quote, you know, throw it all away. I didn't see it as that. I just saw it as a need to serve, and I pushed forward. I never really worried whether I could survive. You know, I might not have gotten back into TV, but there was discussion, and sometimes I wonder, had I run for mayor, and many people suggested, run for council in the 2003, which would have positioned me to run for mayor again in 2005. And several people behind the scenes have said, hey, this might be the best avenue to run for mayor again in 2005. But, you know, those things take a lot out of you. And, you know, you get beat up pretty bad on the when you run for office. And but yeah, there are many things that I would do differently. I stayed away from a lot of the interviews. This was my life that I was putting on the line, and
yeah,
and I was learning as I proceeded. So it was an interesting time.
Great stuff, Curtis. Thanks so much. We catch you on Twitter at Curtis WLWT. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Hey, we'll be checking you out on Twitter and on Channel 5. And thanks so much for taking all this time today and sharing your insight on this.
Anytime. And if that decision ever changes,
please let us know.
I will send you an email before the press conference.
Thanks so much. Take care.
All right. You guys Bye-bye. Take care, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It was so great actually talking to Curtis and not just watching him on TV these days. I'm so glad that he was our guest this week. And I look forward to, you know, seeing more from him as we kind of go forward at this time of change in our country. But we still have, you know, it's been, you know, quite, you know, 20 days here. But I have to tell you, Jason, I loved reading your column this morning.
Thank you.
I usually know like what the topics are. I can see them like on morning notes and Teams. But I didn't see this one coming. And it was honestly, I loved reading it because you wrote about a visit to Smail Park, which I love and go to often. But why don't you tell everyone, I feel like you found a place of joy this weekend in tough times. So,
yeah, no.
You write that. It was a personal essay almost and not our typical political insight.
Yeah, I just thankful to our bosses. Like, they encourage, you know, me to branch out from politics and write, you know, pretty much whatever I want to write, which is a huge responsibility and a huge blessing. And I just thought, and last week was, you and I talked about this offline, Sherry, like last week just felt like everyone was exhausted, not just America in general. And I felt like I was among those folks that you just felt pretty exhausted by 2020 and everything that's going on. And I, the job that we have, and we constantly are talking to sources and tweeting and checking Twitter. And I just felt like really sucked into it and kind of drained by it. And I was going to continue to be sucked into it, except for my wife says on Sunday afternoon, like, "Hey, I'm going out with my friend and the boys are all yours. Get off your phone and do something." And I was just kind of like, I felt like that was a wake up call to go do something. And so I took my sons, Reed and Roman, 7 and 3 years old. And Reed wanted to go to,
if you see them, mini Jasons, keep going.
And Reed wanted to go to Snail Riverfront Park. We hadn't been in a while. The guys hadn't been downtown since the quarantine, and I hadn't been down in several weeks just because, you know, we're not working downtown right now, and or in our office anyway. And so we went down there, but on our way down, we ended up going to Oakley to run a few errands, get a car wash, and then we went down 71. And Reed is incredibly inquisitive, asks questions about questions about questions. And although the one question he did not ask is, are we there yet? Are we almost there? Are we almost there? Which is the one he always asks. But, you know, he starts reading all these street signs, Xavier University. What's that? Is that a college? They play the Bearcats, blah, blah, blah. And then we come up to the MLK interchange. He says, Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. And I'm kind of like, okay, where's he going with this? And I'm like, this is kind of cool. Like, I feel like we're rediscovering Cincinnati. Or something's going on. So I click on my recorder on my phone just because I'm like, let's see where this goes. And my audio recorder, not a video or anything. And he says, he's had this great line about Martin Luther King. And I'm kind of like, wait, are you 7 years old? And it was like, he brought black and white people together when they were they had been separated, but he brought them together. He was a very good guy. And I like started to almost choke up. And so we keep going and we drive by the new Kroger and we see the new Kroger and we go and we see the baseball stadium. And every time they point out all these things, I'm thinking like, oh, these are all the great things that we love about Cincinnati. And then we go to Smale. And Smale, if listeners haven't been there in a while, is just, it's a really magical place. And as much as I've been critical of the banks, and rightfully so, they did Smale Riverfront Park right. And all the people who donated to that, I thank all of them. Because Smale, it is... it's so diverse. You feel like you're not even in Cincinnati, but you are. And I mean, black people and white people and Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans and Indian Americans. This Indian lady asked me like to take her picture of her and her family and stand in front of the river. And I saw, a couple guys my age and an African-American guy my age all hanging out together. And I'm not trying to be like Pollyannish or anything like that, given what's going on. But it's almost like it just restores your hope in society and your hope in people and your hope in our ability to get along. And, we spent 2 hours there, and I would just encourage anyone on a beautiful sunny Saturday or Sunday. And I haven't really been during the week, so I don't know if it's like this during the week, but certainly when people are off work and kids.
There's plenty of people. I go in the morning sometimes early. There's plenty of people there. Like, it's truly a draw, and it was done right. You know, with all the things we, you know, we write a lot of critical things, you and I, you know, but this park is something that was done right. All our parks really, they're just, they've been a respite, and this park in particular for us, because it's pretty close to where we live. And
but I said, you know, yeah, go ahead. I mean, Sherry, and you know this too, like, I feel like it's a beautiful place, and that, and it's a beautiful park, and how it was built and the landscaping and all that, but that's not what I'm talking. I'm talking about the people who come there and gather, and people are nice. And again, it's, you know, I'm not trying to be like, you know, Pollyannish or anything like that, but you don't see this in Cincinnati. You don't, well, I guess you do there, but you don't, it's hard to go to places in this area, in this region, probably in this entire state and tri-state, where you see this racially diverse and ages, all people, I mean, infants all the way up to elderly. And there's just something really, really cool about it. And I know that I'm sounding like disingenuous by, and you know, it's just not, that's not my style. And it was funny because someone put on Twitter, like, you know, Jason's not usually a cheerleader, and it's not my job to be a cheerleader, but it's not my job. Like, it's my job to write my opinion and give insight on the city,
well,
and on politics.
I also think it is important to see things with fresh eyes right now. Like, with everything that's going on, and, like, make sure that we're really looking around and we're not just thinking the same things and being the same. And we have to really, like, be open to what's going on around us. And I feel like I've definitely been more that way. And your column crystallized that idea of, like, with your kids, like, fresh eyes.
Well, thanks. Yeah. And I think the other thing too was, like, I need to listen to my kids more. Yeah, and they're not aware of what's going on in the world right now, but, you know, for them to still, you know, see all these things in the city or around us and get excited about it, is, there's just something refreshing about it. And, I don't know, kind of lifts your spirits at a time when things are, yeah, my brother's a police officer. I think, I don't know if we talked about that, but, you know, just really, really been worried about him, and just generally worried about our country and, you know, our racial tension. And, you know, we're journalists and we see all this stuff, and I think maybe in some ways we compartmentalize it. And sometimes you just got to get out and put the phone down and forget about the news for a minute and enjoy the moment.
Well, I do feel like it was inspired. It's going to inspire people to go down there, because I'm going to take Jack down there, because it's been a while. I've been going by myself. And so it's, you know, so you put that, I put that on the list now for the weekend.
And well, I guess we could probably say this in the fun segment too. Thanks for bringing that up, by the way. I appreciate you asking me about it. When your story, as we record here on Tuesday, my column on that went up today, and you had a story that went up today on Emilio Estevez writing a letter to the mayor of Cincinnati saying, open the streetcar. I mean, that's, I mean, what a crazy time we're living in.
You know, really, I hadn't, you know, we did see the streetcars defunded, I mentioned earlier. I hadn't really written about that yet. Just, of course, there's going to be, you know, a battle over it in the budget. And, you know, there's been a lot of other things to write about. And so I hadn't really written about it. And when I kind of spotted the letter on Facebook last night, and I was like, well, this is an excellent way to get into this. So that was a fun night, because I was trying, calling around to make sure that it was real, as we're supposed to do. And so
yes.
Emilio Estevez himself called to say, I really did write that. I was like, okay. And then we had a conversation. I wrote the story kind of late. It went up this morning. And overnight, he sent me a picture of himself on the streetcar. I kind of woke up to that this morning. And then your column. I was like, okay, it's a Tuesday.
And you had a funny tweet also about your husband, Alex, who's also been a special co-host on the podcast. What did he say? Like, you said, I'm on the phone with Emilio Estevez, and
well, he walked by and he's like, who was that? I was kind of late. And yes, like, who are you talking to this late? And I was like, Emilio Estevez. And he's like, no, really? And I'm like, nope, Emilio Estevez.
Of course, those of us who are in our 40s and children of the 80s, like you and I, and we all know Emilio Estevez very well. So,
no, absolutely. I mean, I'm planning on calling my friends later and be like, Emilio Estevez sent me a selfie. Which you can see in the story. So the letter is, you know, Emilio Estevez to the mayor. And you can see that picture. I embedded it in the story a little bit ago.
Yeah. And good stuff.
All right.
The weather's been great. I hope the weather will continue to be great because I think that lifts spirits too.
I'm going to be inside the whole week.
I've never been one to talk about the weather. And I always, so much of my life, when people will mention it, I'll be like, oh, yeah, this is a phony guy. They're like, you want to start the conversation about the weather. And now I'm kind of like, oh, yeah, the weather is a really important thing.
You know what, though? It is important in the way that you're saying. But I mean, something I learned in journalism school is a lot of, you know, conversations with people that you're going to interview for stories start with something that you have in common. And, of course, yeah, that's the weather. But I had a journalism teacher say, that's boring. You need to, you know, talk about the things that are going on around you in the cities that you're covering. And you know what that is here? Sports. I have noticed we would be talking about baseball. There would be baseball, like, oh, are we winning? Are we losing? Like, all of these conversations, we'd be talking about soccer and just having these. Those would be the opening lines of things. And we don't have those things. Soccer's about to ramp up again. We haven't really had that. It's like this common thread of our city because it's not happening. And so the weather has been more of a default, like everyone's experiencing the weather.
Let's get out to the park and all that. Yeah, mm-hmm. So good stuff. Check us out at Sharon Coolidge on Twitter, at J Williams Cincy with a Y. Email us jwilliams@inquirer.com, scoolidge@inquirer.com. Your feedback is really important. Really appreciate it. And your support of this podcast continues to be tremendous. We thank you so much. And we will catch you next week.